and she may feel a lesser person because of it. What is valued all around her at school and in the culture at large is relationship success, and she's not achieving it. Susie Younessi, a 35-year-old filmmaker in Los Angeles, has vivid memories of heartbreak as a girl growing up in Buffalo in the 1990s. It was an experience that happened over and over again, she said. Everything is amplified when you're young because you haven't been numbed. She confided her crushes and breakups in her epic collection of diaries, addressing the entries to Lemon Lima, her imaginary friend. Younessi grew up listening to her Persian grandmother's fairy tales about little girls and creatures who triumphed over difficult circumstances. For her first feature film, Dear Lemon Lima, she wanted to create a fairy tale about lost love that captured the poignancy of the experience and gave girls a glimpse of a self-affirming future beyond. You hear so much about girls as victims, but not of how they come back from that experience and how heartbreak can make them stronger and more empowered, she said. Dear Lemon Lima was produced with an unabashed sugar-coated aesthetic, with bright pastel colors and curly-cue script diary entries, each eye dotted with a heart. Set in rural Alaska, the film tells the story of 13-year-old Vanessa L'Amour as she recovers from her breakup with Philip. He is white, entitled, and arrogant. She is the daughter of a single white mother and an Eskimo father she hasn't seen in years. Vanessa attends Philip's school on a scholarship for Native Alaskans, even though she feels estranged from her heritage. She becomes so insecure and needy about Philip that her mother, frustrated, chastises her. How can you love anyone when you don't love yourself? The turning point in the movie comes when Vanessa and Philip are pitted against each other as rival team captains in their school's annual snowstorm survivor competition. Vanessa finally sees Philip for the social climber he is. She bonds closely with her teammates, a group of fellow outcasts. To everyone's surprise, Vanessa's underdog team wins. The movie wasn't distributed far beyond the film festival circuit in the U.S., though I wish it had the traction of the Twilight series. Vanessa's triumph is the perfect antidote to Bella Swan's willingness to destroy herself over her love for a handsome vampire. I watched Dear Lemon Lima with Clara as part of the not-so-subtle, unrequited love awareness campaign I've been conducting ever since our princess phase discussions. That probably sounds hyper-vigilant, but it's actually been a lot of fun. Clara still thinks romance is icky and covers her eyes when movie characters kiss. She doesn't want to watch the mythical happy ending of the unrequited love script when the girl finally gets the guy or vice versa. It was much more satisfying for Clara to cheer Vanessa on to victory and proclaim that Philip was a real idiot. I can only hope that the film has some impact on her sense of possibility later on, when she no longer finds kissing a repulsive prospect. I do realize that movies don't work medicinally. And I know that the recovery process of most real-life teen heartbreak won't be as resoundingly triumphant as Vanessa's experience. But the smaller, authentic victories over heartache can matter quite a lot. Sally was a freshman at her large Southern Arizona high school when her crush on Roger, a boy in one of her classes, began. As a Mormon, she wasn't allowed to date until she was 16, then over a year away. Because of this rule, she took longer than her peers to get interested in boys. As her classmates started to have crushes in junior high, she remained studious and uninterested. After Roger gave an about-me presentation for a class they were in together, she decided to try to talk to him. "I was shy and didn't have a lot of guy friends," she said. I decided I would have one for once. I had never had a conversation go so well. I was smooth and funny. It was kind of magical. For the next 2 years, she was preoccupied with finding opportunities to get closer to Roger. She went with her friends to his soccer games. She tried to text and Facebook him, but he was antisocial online and didn't respond. She borrowed his Harry Potter books one by one. Each time she finished a book, she would return it to him and try to say something interesting about it, but she couldn't manage to get much of a conversation going. She kept trying to recapture the magic of the first time they talked, but it didn't happen. He never made the effort to talk to her first, so she soon realized he wasn't interested. "For the longest time, I was really sad about it," she said. "I was still very attached to him in this puppy-dog way. I was so upset." Sally's mother consoled her when she needed to cry and vent. Her mother told me that she knew her daughter was in the spotlight at school. Sally had confided in so many friends that the word had spread about her crush. "He was into sports and didn't get girls," her mother said. "Everyone knew she was infatuated with him. It probably scared the shorts off of him." I admired Sally's mother for her matter-of-fact approach to her daughter's crush and for her humor. She joked that there were times when she wanted to go out and beat Roger with a pan for his obliviousness. I recognized what was behind her kidding, the feeling that you would do anything to protect your kid from the pain of not being loved. All she could do, though, was focus on her daughter's state of mind. "My goal was to walk her through it and keep her self-esteem high," she said. "I told her it happens to everyone, and it's not a reflection on her." Sally sought creative outlets for what she was feeling. She wrote poetry and song lyrics. She got a lot more involved in her school's active theater program. "The experience exposed me to this whole new aspect of being human and feeling emotion, and I could put that into my acting," she said. Midway through her junior year, she learned that Roger was dating someone else, and she resolved to move on. Then she was cast as the outspoken lesbian feminist Enid Hoops in the musical Legally Blonde, itself a fable about turning romantic rejection into empowerment. Enid is a classmate and eventual friend to Elle, the show's lovelorn, girly, blonde-turned-powerhouse law student protagonist. "Enid is a strong character who doesn't need a man," Sally said. "People laughed at things she believed in and had a lot of emotions about. She gets hurt, but she's able to move past it and laugh back at them. As I was playing that character, I was able to look at all the growth I did. I had been dependent on this one person for my happiness, and I wasn't going to be that way anymore." As I thought about Sally's story, the prospect of coping with Clara's first crushes no longer seemed so trying. The pain of a crush like Sally's is not something a mother looks forward to, but I could imagine looking forward to the changes that could occur after that pain subsides. A new resilience, a new repertoire of feeling, qualities my daughter can use on the stage she cherishes or off. 8. Primal Teacher, The Transformation of Unrequited Love. When Rena, an opera singer, was a conservatory student, she fell in love with a young conductor, a rising star who would become world-renowned. What he brought to her was a rare glimpse into something much bigger than what she'd experienced thus far, the feeling of what the real world of professional opera was like. She spent as much time as she could in his orbit, absorbing everything he had to say about music. Even though she knew he was gay, she let herself hope that she could cultivate the deep connection she felt into some kind of transcendent, union-of-the-soul relationship. Yet he held himself apart from her and the many students he entranced. The overriding feeling I had about him was that he was never a very genuine person, said Rena, 43. He was always on. Once in a blue moon, I felt like I got a piece of him when he was being honest with me. Rena shaped her days around finding opportunities to be with the young conductor. On her way to the practice rooms, she would check the papered-over window on his office door to see if a light was glowing inside. She looked forward with childlike excitement to rehearsals with him. She felt helpless to her attraction. I thought, can I please stop feeling this way? Because I felt like a live wire the electric company had yet to shut down. During her last semester, the conductor chose Rena for the challenging lead role in Puccini's Suor Angelica. The opera is about a nun whose out-of-wedlock baby was taken from her 7 years before. When she learns her son has died, she is grief-stricken and swallows poison. Then she realizes she has committed a mortal sin and is destined for hell. She calls out to the Virgin Mary, pleading for absolution. On opening night, as Rena sang this passage, she felt overcome with emotion. Her vocal cords tightened, and she wasn't experienced enough to work around it. Oh, Madonna, salvami! Oh, Madonna, save me, she sang, her voice cracking in an ugly, tense way on the high B. She was terrified she wouldn't be able to make it through the demanding passage ahead. Then the conductor gave her the most intense look Rena had ever seen. He was willing me with his eyes to get me back on track and finish the song. He knew I knew how to do it, and he was going to push me over the top, she said. I was utterly overwhelmed. Moments later, the nun realizes she is saved and is carried up to heaven. Rena's final vocal gesture was a colossal fortissimo high C, which came out of me gloriously by means I couldn't explain, she remembered. It was a larger-than-life moment, the potboiler tragic love story on stage, the pivotal high note, the conductor's glare evoking Svengali, the impresario who hypnotizes a tone-deaf trilby into becoming an opera star. Rena's triumphant finish redeemed her from her mistake, as her nun character was redeemed from her sin. The final high note signified another kind of redemption, from the failure of unrequited love. True, the conductor would never love her back. In this respect, Rena's compulsive rounds of the conservatory and all her daydreaming were fruitless, but her obsession was also what unleashed her into a moment of transcendence and heightened her understanding of what it meant to be a performer. Throughout her obsession with the conductor, the specter of the out-of-control stalker haunted Rena. She did everything she could to avoid making her attraction known. I would rather die than seem to be stalking, she said. Instead, she brought the compulsion of a stalker to her education, harnessing the unwanted woman's blend of abjection and aggression in the service of her music. She submitted completely to the conductor's guidance. That's an unhealthy way to be in real life, she said. But on stage, there's an inherent sort of slave-mind, slave-master thing going on. Under his direction, she could be her purest self, really an unself, completely absorbed in making music. The state, as she described it, sounded a lot like the perfect union she'd fantasized about having with the conductor, yet she experienced it with her singing instead of with him. We have seen how a conscious scrutiny of unrequited love can tell us a lot about what we want in our lives. We also know that if we chase unrequited love too hard, we can cause harm to others or ourselves or both. Rena's story raises another important possibility, that we may be able to do something with unrequited love and use it to our benefit. About a third of the women in my online survey responded that their unrequited love experience changed my life for the better. The beloved can become a taskmaster and a muse, our impossible desire for him a primal teacher, guiding us toward accomplishment and transforming our lives. The seemingly contradictory outcomes of romantic obsession, constructive and hurtful, are not mutually exclusive. Rena's accomplishment did not erase the pain of the conductor's lack of interest, which she felt acutely for years, every time their paths crossed in the music world. Ancient Greeks believed the god of Eros was created out of these disparate forces. He was the offspring of Aphrodite, the goddess of beauty, and Ares, the god of war. Eros embodied the creative and destructive power of love in the figure of a mischievous child who struck lovers and poets with the divine madness of romantic obsession. The same kind of energy, the myth suggests, lies behind both the urge to create and the urge to love. Sappho, the ancient Greek poet whose work expresses the intensity of romantic longing, called Eros bittersweet for the combination of pleasurable and painful feelings his victims endured. Jungian analyst Jacqueline Wright wrote that desire, which engages every lover in an activity of the imagination, opens up possibility because the lover is forced to notice what is missing. This realization has the potential to make us dream, change, and create. The creative urge that is channeled toward another person can be taken back and owned, she said. This state, both grandiose and needy, can be highly fragile, as Sappho's own story attests. A main preoccupation of her poetry, which survives mainly in enigmatic verse fragments, is the Socratic idea of pothos, translated as yearning, longing, or regret for that which is elsewhere. At times addressed to female beloveds and at times to male, her poetry moves from soaring, hopeful imagery to descriptions of great pain. The persona of Fragment 31 describes how the laughter of a beloved puts the heart in my chest on wings. A few lines later, the sight of the same beloved leads to a mortal fit. Cold sweat holds me, and shaking grips me all. Greener than grass I am, and dead, or almost, I seem to me. As poetic legend has it, Sappho ended her own life in the throes of unrequited love. She supposedly jumped off the Leucadian cliffs into the sea after Phaon, a young ferryman, rejected her. The leap which Ovid wrote about in the Heroides cannot be proved as fact. But the staying power of the story points to our fears about the creative potential of romantic obsession, that it is a precursor to ruin. Yet accomplishment is often what rescues the unwanted woman from ruin and gives her an outlet for her restless longing. One reason why people love someone who doesn't love them back is so they can be inspired by love. Psychologists Arthur and Elaine Aron call this the Don Quixote situation. In Miguel de Cervantes's early 17th century novel, Don Quixote devotes his chivalric quests to his unrequited love, a neighboring farm girl he renames Dulcinea. Even though she never responds, his adoration allows him to experience heightened emotion, focus his life goals, and enjoy being inspired to act heroically in someone else's name. For those in the Don Quixote situation, love is an adventure, a mystery to be solved. They are the stars of the story, privileged figures in an exciting world of emotional extremes. Interestingly, Cervantes portrayed Don Quixote as a satirical, largely ineffectual figure. He attacks windmills, believing them to be giants, and insists on rescuing a lady from a band of what he perceives as malevolent wizards, who are in fact a group of friars. His heroism often verges on buffoonery. Better evidence of the power of being in unrequited love comes from Mary Wollstonecraft, one of the most prominent figures in the history of feminism and the author of A Vindication of the Rights of Woman. In 1793, Wollstonecraft fell in love with Gilbert Imlay, a restless American entrepreneur. The first few months of their affair were idyllic. Neither lover approved of the institution of marriage and its artificial demands. Commitments, they believed, should last only as long as the feeling of love. Yet she came to believe that what they had together was sacred unto itself, creating a connection more durable than the marital bond. Imlay had a different take on the situation, which became acutely apparent after they conceived a child together. Imlay was away on business for a good deal of her pregnancy. When the baby was just a few months old, Imlay departed again, this time for London. He promised to send for Wollstonecraft and baby Fanny, who remained behind in France. He was cooling on the relationship, though, and started up with another lover. His letters to her became shorter and less frequent. She wrote to him often and with great fervor, trying to convince him of his obligation to continue to love her. He finally asked her to come to London, but not as his partner. He arranged for her to live in separate furnished lodgings. Soon after she arrived, she tried to kill herself by swallowing laudanum. After she recovered, Imlay made a startling proposal. He asked her to travel to Scandinavia to negotiate compensation for a cargo of silver he believed had been stolen. The suggestion, in the wake of his betrayal and abandonment, was quite an audacious brush-off. He was asking his emotionally fragile ex to sally forth, baby daughter and maid in tow, on a rough and dangerous journey into unsettled territory, all for the sake of his business interests, his perennial excuse for distancing himself from Wollstonecraft. She regularly accused him of neglecting her in favor of his many commercial ventures. "You seem to be got into a whirl of projects and schemes which are drawing you into a gulf that, if it does not absorb your happiness, will infallibly destroy mine," she wrote from Paris in 1795. Yet there Imlay was, conspiring to draw her into that same gulf, likely hoping that it would distract her and get her out of his hair. The plan included sending her away with a sworn statement that she was his wife. The document would give Wollstonecraft the authority to act on Imlay's behalf, but it also underscored the ways he was using her. Though their transcendent union was in tatters, he didn't hesitate to give her the title of wife when it might strategically benefit him. Wollstonecraft saw opportunity instead of insult. The mission gave her a new challenge. Even though she was working on Imlay's behalf, she was also doing what she was best at, breaking new ground as a woman. She reveled in the continual surprise of being a woman in the male role of hero adventurer, babe in arms and all. Her journey gave her a new subject to write about. In journal entries and letters, she took in the craggy beauty of Scandinavia and brought to bear her keen, analytical mind in observations of local politics and customs. She bathed in the sea, took long walks, and rode horses. She negotiated strenuously on Imlay's behalf, though she failed to get the money he sought. She was by no means cured of her obsession with him. Her letters to Imlay continued to refer to her broken-hearted state. She still struggled with thoughts of suicide and was haunted by the question of whether she and Imlay would reconcile when she returned. But a steady sense of purpose on her travels kept her from dwelling too long on sadness. Far away from her beloved, Wollstonecraft could do something with her love. She could be someone new, even with her heavy heart. In Imlay's presence, she had to face the fact of his rejection. Once she returned to England, she discovered he had taken up with yet another lover. She tried to kill herself again. This time, she dressed in heavy velvets, weighted her pockets with rocks, and, hoping to sink quickly, jumped off the Putney Bridge into the Thames. After she was rescued, she made a few more desperate pleas for reconciliation. When she was refused again by Imlay, her thoughts returned to the adventure that had revived her spirits before. She knew her journey and the devotion that had inspired it were worth something, emotionally, creatively, and financially. She asked Imlay to return the letters she sent from Scandinavia and published many of them, enriched by her journal entries as letters written during a short residence in Sweden, Norway, and Denmark. The book was a hybrid of epistolary travelogue, memoir, political analysis, and sociology. It was a tremendous commercial success. Much of its appeal came from its subplot of longing. Her letters regularly allude, somewhat obliquely, to her heartache, often followed by reassurances that she was overcoming the pain. By the time Letters was published, her personal story was no secret. Instead of letting her intimations of subjugation and woe discredit Wollstonecraft's feminism, as some modern critics have done, her readers connected with the creature of feeling and imagination behind the astute philosopher. Wollstonecraft was caught up in a passion that drove her to great lengths. Her letters to Imlay were compulsively frequent, her rhetoric at times as well-honed as anything in a vindication, at times verging on humiliating supplication. "You could restore me to life and hope, and the satisfaction you would feel would amply repay you. For God's sake, keep me no longer in suspense. Let me see you once more." She infamously begged to be included in a ménage à trois household with him and his new lover, and that was not the first time she'd made such a proposal. She'd thrown out the idea at a previous lover, a married artist. But she fought despair by making something out of the frenzied energy of unrequited love. She cloaked herself, Don Quixote style, in the mantle of the aspiring lover and went on a heroic journey. And the Imlay she imagined, the man with whom she shared a transcendent and enduring bond, above any social custom or law, was, like Dulcinea, a fantasy. What she created out of the idea of him was real. Letters, the last book Wollstonecraft published, isn't her best-known work, but it contains the statement that best explains the tie between her life story and her political analysis. "We reason deeply when we forcibly feel." Her writing was a way of turning degradation into power, of getting the last and most enduring word out of a situation that might have silenced her forever. This gesture of using unrequited love as a goad to creativity has endless variations. Literary critics believe that Charlotte Bronte's impassioned letters to Constantine Heger, the married Belgian teacher with whom she was enamored, were close to an imaginative act, her way of beginning to enact the passionate expressiveness that would distinguish Jane Eyre and Villette. Shortly after she wrote her last letter to Heger, she hatched her famous plot to publish a volume of poetry she wrote with her sisters, Anne and Emily, under the male pseudonyms Currer, Ellis, and Acton Bell. 2 years later, she published Jane Eyre, a book that stunned its original audience with its emotional frankness. This frankness becomes playfully raw in contemporary French conceptual artist Sophie Calle's installation, Prenez soin de vous, Take Care of Yourself. She incorporated the filmed and photographed responses of more than 100 women to a breakup email she received from her lover. She selected the women for their wide range of professional and intellectual perspectives. A criminologist pronounces her ex an authentic manipulator who is psychologically dangerous. A human rights specialist tells Calla she should be relieved to be rid of him. A woman in a short, strapless yellow dress, her straight brown hair swaying over her face like a curtain, performs a plodding conceptual dance. A 9-year-old girl wonders why, if the email author says he loves Calla, is he leaving her? The abundance of the installation reflects the excessiveness of obsession, the endless pondering of what a lover and his rejection means. It is also a kind of extravagant revenge. If you don't want me, I will make something out of us anyway. This threat comes from within the relative safety of art. Chris Krause's 1997 novel, I Love Dick, is part one-sided epistolary novel, part confessional diary, and part public document of her real-life exhaustive and failed obsession with the eponymous Dick, a British cultural critic teaching at a university in California. He responds to her outpourings mainly with silence, evasion, and a single night in his bed. When she asks him to have sex with her, he consents with the evasive, "I'm not uncomfortable with that idea." She has said that the real Dick was so alarmed by the publication of the novel that he was going to sue her for invasion of privacy, then changed his mind. There are less edgy expressions of unrequited longing pretty much everywhere. At any given moment, you can find an unwanted woman who makes art out of lost love at an open mic night, or in a community poetry workshop, or in the top 40 rotation on the radio. We have familiar ways of describing what happens when people make use of frustrated love. There's the Freudian idea of sublimation, the deflecting of sexual desire into higher pursuits. We may simply say the unwanted woman has finally found the right distraction, following the "stay busy" admonition so common in women's magazine articles about getting over him. Yet these explanations don't really take into account the devotional aspect of what unrequited love can inspire. Wollstonecraft traveled and wrote, not in spite of Imlay, not to forget Imlay, but because of Imlay. In her precarious state, if she could not see these pursuits as being for him, she probably would not have taken them on. Krauss has said that Dick gave me someone to write to, the mystery of his silence impelling her work. What is it about the state of romantic obsession that induces some unrequited lovers to action and creation? Shamir Zeki, a professor of neuroaesthetics at University College London and a pioneer in the modern study of visual perception, asserts that creativity is a fundamental human response to the frustrations of love. We carry within us an inherited universal ideal of passionate love as an experience of union. Love stories, mythology, and philosophy from both Western and non-Western cultures portray the desire of two lovers to merge into one being. The neurochemistry of passionate love makes us feel that this ideal is within our grasp. The release of dopamine in the reward center of the brain causes euphoria and exhilaration. Activity in the amygdala, where the fear response is generated, quiets down, promoting feelings of bravery. There's less blood flow to areas of the brain associated with judgment and negative emotions. The self, so emboldened and accepting, is readied to give itself over, as these changes in the brain weaken the divide between self and other, reinforcing the concept of union in love. But a true merging exists only as an imagined ideal. Human experience will always fall short. Even in a loving sexual relationship, partners are confined to their separate selves. Several recent studies indicate that the release of dopamine is as connected to desire, the expectation of reward, as it is to the feeling of receiving the rewards of love and sex. The reward of physical and emotional intimacy leads to longing for more. The climax, as Zeki puts it, immediately becomes an anti-climax. The impossibility of fully experiencing romantic oneness with another gives the unrequited lover a strange advantage when it comes to creativity. "Begone from me! Love for you so engages me that I have no time for you," Majnun reprimands his beloved Layla in the renowned Persian fable. Her presence disrupts his created fantasy of their perfect love, expressed through the poetry he writes in the sand. He can invest all he wants in his creation. It draws him closer to the ideal than Layla, who was married off to another, ever could. Creativity, as Zeki puts it, is a way of coping with the melancholy of unsatisfied yearning for unity. Creativity can step in as a way to respond to the gap between the unity in love concept and reality. Creative effort, exerted by the business manager, the child building a sandcastle, the painter, the poet, engages the brain in a struggle similar to the struggle for love. Both involve the reward system, the brain's quest for satisfaction. Both the lover and the artist have the challenge of creating something real out of a concept in their heads. Both will, more often than not, find that reality falls short. Both will try again and again to figure out how to get it right. Just as I once strategized and re-strategized ways into B's heart, coy distance and waiting, insistent confrontation, I will rewrite this paragraph many times. The magnitude of feeling varies, of course. My diligence in crafting this paragraph is only a quiet echo of my diligence in the pursuit of B. But the fundamental similarities in the processes of creativity and passionate love matter. They are both a form of emotional currency. We ponder to what extent one pursuit can be exchanged for another, hence our long-standing intrigue with the virgin authoress, a stock figure of 19th-century literary history. She makes herself a nun in the Church of Art, living her life without mutual romantic love. The shadow of unrequited love frequently hangs over her, creating mysteries. Who was the man behind Jane Austen's insights into romance, Tom Lefroy or Dr. Samuel Blackall? Who gave rise to Emily Dickinson's heartsick verse, Reverend Charles Wadsworth, her mentor and correspondent, her sister-in-law, Susan Gilbert? These spinsters seem to have made a bargain with Eros. Strike me with your arrow, and I will make art instead of love. This sort of deal frees them to dwell on the imagined perfection of ideal love instead of mutual love's faulty lived reality. In this way, they are like Dante and Werther, yet the spinster artist has even more at stake. Mutual love almost inevitably led to domesticity and babies and far less time and space for a creative mind. The unwanted woman, historically, was a freer woman. We still contend with this legacy. The pop singer Adele wrote the Grammy Award-winning Someone Like You and the rest of her smash hit album 21 in response to the end of a rubbish relationship. When she fell in love again and got pregnant, She offered a satisfying resolution to her woe. One of my daughter's friends, at age 9, proclaimed exuberantly, "Adele has a new boyfriend, and she's going to have a baby, and she'll never be sad again." Her mother sagely warned her that life has no such guarantees. There was one immediate drawback to Adele's happy ending, less of her music. Adele announced that she would need to take a break from touring for several years, leaning out, we might call it, to help her new domesticity survive. "If I am constantly working, my relationships fail," she said. "The misery of imperfect love," Zeki writes, "generates splendors in its turn, with the brain's capacity to turn that discontent into creative achievement." Based on existing brain scan research on how people respond to art, Zeki surmised that the creative process likely involves the orbital frontal cortex, thought to be related to emotion and reward in decision-making. As the brain lights on a work of art that it considers beautiful, blood flow steps up in this area, causing a feeling of satisfaction. A decrease in blood flow is a sign of dissatisfaction. Similar fluctuations, Zeki discovered, occurred in the caudate nucleus, found near the center of the brain. The caudate nucleus also activates in response to passionate love. It's the place that integrates more complex thoughts and emotions from different brain regions with the primal dopamine-fueled rush of desire. The neural maps of our reactions to beauty and to love, then, literally overlap. The common ground in the processes of love, rejection, and creativity suggests it isn't a very far leap, physiologically speaking, from the pursuit of love to the pursuit of art, particularly for the unrequited lover, who is left empty-handed and unoccupied as the reward of reciprocated love escapes her. One recent study shows that for people who have a high need to feel unique, a common characteristic of artists and innovators, social rejection causes them to score higher on tests of creativity. The outsider identity, which rejection reinforces, nurtures their ability to innovate. Famed dancer Isadora Duncan insisted that love and art were inextricable, and that she spent her life always madly in love. As a young dancer living in France, she suffered a double whammy of romantic rejection. She arranged a dinner with champagne and roses for a man she adored, only to watch him rush off in a panic from the romantic scene. She turned in consolation to another suitor, who thrilled her by checking them into a hotel room under the assumed names of a married couple. Finally, she thought in ecstasy, she would know what love was. But the man backed away, evidently fearful about taking her virginity, and sent her home in a cab. "This last shock," she wrote in her 1927 autobiography, My Life, "had a decided effect on my emotional nature, turning all its force toward my art, which gave me the joys which love withheld." Her connection to dance became more profound. She would stand for hours with her hands folded between her breasts, covering what she came to believe was the central spring of all movement in the body. She would develop her highly influential school of dance based on this idea. It was a marked departure from the predominant theory that movement had to stem from the base of the spine, a concept that Duncan said yielded a mechanical movement not worthy of the soul. The image of Duncan standing in such profound focus and discovery says much about the potential for creativity to arise out of unrequited love. Even if artistic perfection can be as elusive as perfect love, the cycle of reward-seeking, dissatisfaction, and satisfaction in making art depends on what the unwanted woman can accomplish herself, not how the beloved responds to her. The stories of great artists, I realize, set the bar high. I know from my own experience that the shift from one reward system to another is no magic bullet. There's no recipe for turning the energy of longing into something productive, only examples showing us that it's possible. The euphoric beginning of my obsession, when winning Bee's love seemed possible, did inspire me to write. But after a few months, I was too distracted to work. It was not until after my obsession ended that I could sit down at a desk again. Even then, I had to be hours away from him, at an artist's colony in another state, where my sole obligation was to write. I wasn't writing for him, and I wasn't writing particularly well, but I was glad to have some focus back. What my unrequited love inspired, in the end, was not an accomplishment, but a change within myself. As I recovered, I made a resolution. You can't want anyone who isn't good to you, I decided, with the corollary that I had to be able to be good to that person in turn. It was an embarrassingly simple formula, one that I hope my abundantly confident daughter will follow instinctually. If I'd had that rule with Bee, nothing would have gone past the first indication that he was too confused about his girlfriend to treat me well. I don't know if I would have stopped loving him or prevented myself from becoming obsessed, but I would have kept my respect and sense of self-control. I would have had much less to regret. With this much-needed resolution, my life took a turn that, in retrospect, feels miraculous. Just weeks after Bee told me we could never speak again, I met the man who had become my husband. I was very lucky, scoring my life partner on the rebound. I often wonder how I would have fared if I hadn't met Bill. Yet, as we slowly built our relationship, my new understanding of myself and what love should entail made a difference. I had a standard to go by. I did not want to be the woman who chased too hard again. I needed to make what I had gone through worth something, at least to myself. Later, as I started to deepen my investigation of unrequited love, I met other women who felt that the force of romantic obsession pushed them to change for the better and see their lives anew. The disruptiveness of their unrequited love was, in retrospect, essential. Their obsession pushed them to where they needed to be. Karina is a woman who commands notice. She is tall and curvy and always has on the highest heels in the room, giving her an Amazonian presence. She works in public relations and has a digital Rolodex gilded with celebrities she can convince to do her bidding, often for charity causes. They find her brazenness and Sarah Silverman's sense of humor irresistible. When her son was young, life was a lot quieter. She was restless in her cushy stay-at-home mom life. She spent a lot of time shopping and working out at the gym. Her husband of 15 years had a high-powered advertising job and came home each night preoccupied with work. He wasn't paying much attention to her, and she pointedly told him so. He made an effort, flowers here, compliments there, but he also said he didn't have much time for her. He was too busy making the money she was spending, he explained. I'm a pretty tough cookie, and that wasn't going to cut it, she said. Looking back on it, I probably should have said, we should go to couples therapy or look at this with a mediator. But I didn't do that. Instead, what I did was look across my gym one day and see this very attractive, interesting woman. Who is that? She asked her trainer. That, he said, is trouble. Karina had never been attracted to women before. No fooling around, no crushes, no masturbation fantasies where women creep into it. I liked men and sex with men. But there was Sharon, a graduate student 10 years younger than she was. Karina walked up, introduced herself, and said, "I have to tell you, I find you captivating. Would you like to have lunch?" She gave Sharon her number and waited with mad impatience the 2 days it took for her to call. When they met for lunch, one of the first things Karina said was, "I'm just going to tell you right away. I'm wildly attracted to you. I don't know why. I know nothing about you. I want to know why I'm attracted to you. I want you to tell me more about yourself." During Karina's 6-month obsession, she and Sharon spent days together while Karina's son was at school. Karina often hired afternoon babysitters so they could be with each other longer. They emailed and texted constantly whenever they were apart. They got matching tattoos. Karina wanted badly to sleep with Sharon. They were affectionate and spent a weekend alone together, sharing the same bed. But Sharon refused to have sex with her. "She was very clear about that," Karina said. She said, "There's no way I'm getting involved with a married mother of a child. I'm not going to be your little gay experiment." Karina didn't hide what she was doing from her husband, and he didn't ask her to stop seeing Sharon. "Maybe why she's so important to you is something you need to think about," he said. "I won't stand in your way, but I don't really like the person you're becoming around this." He knew Karina was losing interest in him and pursuing love with someone else. "The intensity was unlike anything that I ever experienced in my entire life, ever, ever," she said. "I've seen pictures of myself from that time. I'm sparkling. I'm wearing pajamas, sitting around someone else's house, and I'm absolutely glowing in the dark." Karina's frustrated desire eventually became unbearable. As she drove Sharon home after an afternoon they'd spent together, they fought. She told Sharon she didn't want to spend time with her anymore. "I said, I can't take it. This is literally killing me. I am torn into a million pieces." After Karina dropped Sharon off, Karina went to dinner with a group of mom friends, several of whom knew what she was going through. She was so distraught that she couldn't sit still. She announced, "Either I'm going to stay here and make this all about me, or I'm going to leave." They looked at her, not knowing what to say. She went home sobbing and threw herself down on her bed. Her husband came into their bedroom to ask what was wrong. "I hate my life," she said. "Can I help you?" he asked. She said no. She knew her marriage had to end, and so did her obsession with Sharon. Karina was beginning to realize they wouldn't last as a couple. But the impact of the relationship was profound. She and her husband got divorced not long after, and she moved upstate. Her next serious relationship was with a woman. They'd been together 8 years, and they recently got married. Karina resists the simplicity of calling her obsession with Sharon a coming-out story. As Karina describes it, the intensity of her feelings made far more of an impact than the fact that Sharon was female. Yet the drama of Karina's obsessive, impossible love made me think of mid-20th century lesbian pulp fiction. Romantic obsession lured women into same-sex affairs, typically with punishing consequences. Protagonists driven by unrequited love to suicide, insanity, or depression. When Patricia Highsmith gave the infatuated heroine of her 1952 novel, The Price of Salt, a hopeful ending with her female beloved, she offered an alternative vision to the purpose of romantic obsession, that it could lead you to a braver and more truthful existence, even in the face of oppressive social convention. Karina's unrequited love took place in a far less homophobic time, yet it had a similar force. It pushed her out of a life that no longer felt genuine to her. Her obsession brought out a self-centeredness that drove her to distance herself from what made her unhappy, her marriage and her stay-at-home mom existence, and court a woman who made her feel alive. Karina's life changed in other ways, too. She had to go back to work after the divorce, and she began to build a career out of the volunteering she'd done during her marriage. "Buying $1,000 handbags could never make me as happy as I am now," she said. "My life is harder now, but the clarity and richness are unparalleled. Sharon, the lover who never was, is still a friend. Karina told me she could telephone Sharon out of the blue and discover they're both playing the same track on the same CD. Sharon was also the tool that ended my marriage," Karina said. "And I certainly couldn't have reached for a more rocket red glare tool than that." Eleanor, a 56-year-old business consultant in Connecticut, arrived at the emotional wake-up call of unrequited love from a very different place. She had a long and satisfying marriage, enviably infused with a spirit of adventure. After her husband retired and she was laid off unexpectedly from her job, they sold their house in Connecticut and went on a cross-country bicycle trip, starting in Key West and ending in St. Stephen, Canada. Not long after they returned home, he was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. She spent the next 2 years helping him fight the disease. "Then I had to give him space to die," she said. "I had to not be angry at him that I would be a widow. It was a huge, difficult journey to take." After he passed away, she resolved to never let herself love so deeply again. She couldn't stand the thought of being that vulnerable with someone else. She went back to work full-time. She was 54 and raising her 2 grandchildren. "I didn't think I'd have another relationship in my life," she said. One of her co-workers was a 31-year-old man from India. They were assigned to manage a long-term project. After a year, she realized that she was intensely attracted to him. Her feelings reminded her of the last time she was in unrequited love. She was 17, and her obsession became self-destructive. "It was like, if you won't look at me, just stab me," she said. "I thought I was going to drive off a fucking cliff." She became so distraught that she nearly killed herself with a drug overdose. Almost 40 years later, as her feelings grew for her colleague, she tried to stifle them. "Here I am, a year out of being widowed. This just can't be. I don't want to have a crush on this guy. This is not the emotional state I want to be in." But that didn't matter. It became an obsession really quickly. She knew there was little chance that they could be together. She was white and older than he was, a double taboo in Indian culture. An affair might jeopardize their jobs. Their work relationship, meanwhile, thrived. They had a similar management style, aggressive, fast-paced, not always strict about the rules. She relished his soft-spoken manner and his youthful energy. She was gratified by how comfortable he seemed with her assertiveness. She realized that instead of feeling devastated over the impossibility of her love, she was enjoying it. Her obsession began to feel like a pleasurable game. "Around him, I'd puff up and slow down my talking," she said. "I would be calmer. I wanted to take it slow. I wanted to be completely present to the sexual energy. At this point in my life, I thought, I'm going to wallow in this." Sometimes she felt distraught over her crush, but she found she didn't have much time to wallow in self-pity. Her grandchildren kept her busy when she wasn't at work. When she did have time alone, she fought down the impulse to jump in her car and find him. She knew where he lived and where he hung out with his friends, but she didn't want to act like she had at 17. She would let herself occasionally flirt with him on work outings, but that was all. One afternoon, as they were preparing for a presentation, he told Eleanor that he was getting a promotion that would take him back to India. She had known this day would come, but she was devastated. She waited 2 days, then told him they needed to talk. They sat down in a conference room. "This isn't about how you feel or your response," she said. "This is about what I need to say. I will..."